Evening, brothers and sisters. Thank you for drawing aside this evening to listen to this talk. I'm mindful as well that there's Brother Michael, Sister Ada, have heard this when I gave this a few weeks ago in house. So by all means, won't be offended if you want to switch off and do something else now. Likewise, anybody else that heard me on that occasion. I'm speaking about Lebanon's woes. I've had a really good day today, and I've got to get myself serious about this because this is a serious topic we're looking at this evening. And I hope it's not going to depress you. That's not the intention, but certainly a lot of the content is very sad, really. And we should feel for people in this part of the world of Lebanon. I've had a bit of a soft spot for Lebanon in a strange sort of distant way, because going way back in 1972, when I went up to the northeast of England, ironically, a few miles south of where I am now, quite a bit south of where I am now, but at the time it seemed a long way north from home. When I went up there, one of the early sort of acquaintances I had was a senior student, I expect he was about 13, I was 18, who came from Lebanon. Strange how your mind works, I can't remember his name, and I've been racking my brains, I just can't remember his name. I knew him for that first year, and I think after that first year, things didn't work out for him, and he went away. But during that short period, I did talk to him quite a bit, and he got me interested in Lebanon. I was intrigued why a Lebanese should even be in a place such as Middlesbrough. But it was for his education, and he came from a rich family. And I remember talking to him, and he was saying how rich Lebanon was. And that surprised me somewhat. And since then, not all the time, but from periodically when Lebanon comes up in the news and so on, I wonder about this character. What happened to him? Because his intention was to go home, bring his education to bear with his family back in Lebanon. Anyway, that's by and by. I'm going to present you now with this horrible picture. I'm sure you haven't seen this one. You've seen something similar. This is the outcome of the awful explosion that took place on August the 4th, just over a month ago, completely devastated the port of Beirut. And Lebanon's only a small country, about the same size geographically as Israel, and about the same in terms of population. Now, this bomb, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, really has created havoc, because 70% of everything that comes into the country of Lebanon was coming in through that port, including 70% of their food. Highly dependent as a country they are on import. So if I've just told you that, and that would be devastating enough without talking about the loss of life and those made homeless and so on and so forth. So this bomb on August the 4th made me sit up and made me mindful again of Lebanon and how sad and tragic the whole situation is for them. I can't possibly do a comprehensive sketch of Lebanon, but I'm going to run through a bit of a history. As we go down the right-hand side, listed as the key sort of happenings to the state of Lebanon. On the left-hand side, obviously, you've got the map, and Lebanon is right there above Israel, isn't it? Sitting right at the top. And it was ruled by the Turks for centuries. And then after the First World War, a mandate was given to the French, and they took a watchful eye of what we know today as Lebanon. And in 1943, the Republic of Lebanon came into being. Actually, 100 years ago, on September the 1st, last week, exactly 100 years ago, the name of Lebanon came to the fore under the French. But it didn't become a republic and break away from the French until 1943. Anyway, then you can see that list, you scan your eyes, some of those things you'll be mindful of. Some I've probably got you to remember now that you've forgotten about. And other things have passed you by altogether. A lot's happened to Lebanon especially in recent decades, and most of it not good. I want to talk about the French mandate because it's important for where we're going to end up this evening in this talk. There was the situation in the First World War where you get the Sykes-Picot Agreement. A British man and a Frenchman literally drew lines in the sand. Sykes was tipped to be a great politician. Ironically, he died at the age of 36, so one knows exactly what may have been with him. But he was there at the right time to draw those lines with the Frenchman. And basically, they carved up the Turkish Empire, as it was in the Middle East, what we call the Middle East. And the French took the northern part of it, which embraces today's modern Syria and Lebanon. And the British took the south, which was Jordan and Israel, in those days obviously known as Palestine, Egypt and so on. So the north, you could say, was French. The south was under British control, a mandate. And the idea of a mandate is that those peoples who were liberated from the Turks would at some point be able to organize themselves and have their own structures and have their own political identity and freedom. And the British and the French were there to help them in doing that. At least that was the initial brief. And the right-hand map I've got on the screen shows you the French mandate. And all I want you to notice from that is that where we've got Lebanon, which is basically the green part there, and the rest is Syria, notice the divisions. Already there are factions, different people living within that mandate. And the French actually did reasonably well in setting things up and having some sort of stability until the Second World War came along. But you can see there the challenge, just in that map on the right, you've got all these different people. When they got their independence, it's actually 1946 when the French left. And in the late 40s into the early 50s, Lebanon did really well. And during those early 1950s, Lebanon as a country had the second highest GDP growth. So in terms of booming an economy, Lebanon had it. They were doing really, really well. A lot of, as I say, structures, they were set up by the French and they flourished. In 1958, however, there was an insurrection. I won't go into the details of that, but it ended up with the Americans going in and 5,000 US Marines were in there for a couple of months or so and re-established order again. And in doing that, things settled down once more. And in the 1960s, I won't read that paragraph, you can perhaps glance through it. Basically, Lebanon flourished as a country dealing with finance and along with banking, tourism. It did really well and prospered. And it was the regional center for finance and trade. And because of that character I knew way back in those days of Teesside Polly, his family did well out of this. And on the basis of his parents being reasonably well off, he was able to come to Britain. So they were doing well. And Beirut was actually coined Paris of the Middle East. Obviously, the French influence, but it was wealthy. It was a place to go for a holiday, lovely warm weather, and there was money there. And finance deals were struck one way or another, and businessmen could go there, do the business, and also have a good time. So it was the Paris of the Middle East. And I just want to put this little note here Lebanon, as a country, had no conflict with Israel during the period 1949 to 1968. No real issue with Israel. Israel and Lebanon got on side by side, okay. In the War of Independence in 1948, the Lebanese, who only had a small army anyway of 3,000, normally put 1,000 towards the Arab effort of driving the Israelis into the sea. But their heart wasn't in it, to be honest. They were not over concerned and they didn't engage much. Well, that was 1948. And the Six-Day War, again, they didn't really get involved. And so during this period where Lebanon was doing quite well, very well, there was relative peace with Israel and an understanding, if I can put it that way. But I want to share with you now some of the further seeds of disaster. In 1966, this big bank collapsed, and that had major financial consequences, had them rocking a little bit financially. And then not long after that, we have the Six-Day War, 1967. They've already got 110,000 Palestinian refugees from 1948, which they looked after and didn't seem to be over a burden, and not a great burden. They managed to sort them out and things were okay. But once that Six-Day War came to an end, a lot more Palestinian refugees went north into Lebanon, and some also went west into Jordan, as you probably remember. Well, those that went north went into Lebanon, and we're starting to get real big problems now. By 1968, you've got Palestinian militants making incursions from the south of Lebanon into Israel. And obviously Israel wasn't very happy about it. The Palestinians who went west into Jordan actually rebelled, as it were, against the governing power of King Hussein of Jordan, who for the most part was a friend of Britain. I'm sure you remember King Hussein. And in 1970, there was a civil war in Jordan. And between 70 and 71, there was a lot of bloodshed in Jordan. But remarkably, I think now when you look back, King Hussein won through and was able to drive the Palestinians out. And Yasser Arafat, how could we possibly forget him? But maybe I need to remind you of this character. He assumed really the leadership of the Palestinians. He went from there into Lebanon with the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Not long after him, George Habash, who led the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, he also went into Lebanon. And this is getting nasty. So by the end of the 1960s, you've got these Palestinians in the south of Lebanon that are using Lebanon as a bit of a springboard to attack Israel. And eventually, 1975, things just went haywire in Lebanon itself. There are just too many tensions. I can't go through this blow by blow of the 15-year war. You don't want me to. I'm just going to show you two maps. This map from 1976, so we're 1 year into the war. And notice the dark green are the Syrians, the purple are the Maronite groups, which basically are Catholic, Christian Catholics of a form, who have a lot of ties and sympathy with Rome, but also with the French. So the Christian group there. And then the light green is now, by this time, been taken over by the likes of the PLO and the Palestinian Liberation Front. So you've got the Palestinians down there. Amazingly, when you look back now, it was the Christians who invited the Syrians to go into Lebanon to help them. You know, it seems surprising when you think the Syrians are basically Muslim, but that's how they came in, the invitation and the Maronites. So there you see them in the north with the Maronites, and you see the real problem as it was then for the Maronites who were the governing power, the Palestinians militias that are in the south. Well, that's 76. Let's move on. In 1983, so we've gone on 7 years, we've got two new colours on the map. And now we've got yellow, which represents the Israelis. And you've got blue area, which represents the United Nations. Now, what a complex situation you've got there. The Israelis felt they had to move in, and they actually invaded Lebanon. And would have taken all of Lebanon in truth, but with the politics of the day and so on. That's how it was in 83, and the United Nations got in there trying to have a buffer zone and so on and so forth. So this is just awful. There's terrible carnage. It's going to ensue for a good few more years yet. And then we have in 1989, something called the Taif Agreement. And this was brokered, of all people, by the Assad family. Can you believe it? It's true, the Syrians. And the idea of this was for the Lebanese to have their own authority and sort of wind the clock back to how it was sort of 1975, before the war started. And the Israelis were reasonably happy with this because they thought some order would be established. It was agreed that the Syrians would move out within 2 years, but they didn't actually leave until 2005. And you might point the finger at them, but I have to tell you, the Israelis didn't move out to the year 2000. So agreement on agreement there in 1989, the bloodshed shed more or less stopped the following year, and this agreement started to be implemented. But the Syrians and the Israelis took a bit of time being satisfied with that and for them to withdraw together. Now look at this, I've just put on in bold type. It's not altogether novel. When Lebanon was first created, because of the different religious groupings and political groupings, it was already decided way back then that certain roles within government would belong to certain parties. Well, with the Taif agreement, Taif, by the way, is in Saudi Arabia, so the Saudi Arabians were involved in this as well. It was decided at this point in time that the Christians, the Maronite Catholic type Christians, that would be the president. The Prime Minister would be a Sunni Muslim, the Speaker of Parliament would be a Shiite, and the Eastern Orthodox would be represented by a Deputy Prime Minister and Deputy Speaker. And so everyone will have a fair say and everything will be just fine. In actual fact, there were 18 officially recognised different groups, different sects, and they all had their quota for Parliament. So this is even more complicated than that list of five preeminent roles that I've put on the screen. And in practice, since the 1990s, all major decisions in Lebanon have been done behind closed doors, and there's been a democracy of a type, but when it comes to elections, the vote in public, in truth, had been very limited as to who they could choose. Just want to show you one more picture about the religious groupings. Now, this is State of Affairs in 2013. There are 8 different colours there, 8 different combinations. There are all the different religious groupings and parties, nationalities that are within this small country of 6.8 million, this small country, you know, that's a little bit smaller than Israel. That's what's going on. You can see it's just a recipe for disaster. And I haven't mentioned the Hezbollah. Now, Hezbollah really came into existence about 1985 from the south of Lebanon, and they are Shiite. And they didn't really get any say on the deal that was struck that brought the civil war to an end. But they, despite that, have come to the fore in a big way. They've had support. Again, you might be surprised by this, by Christian Party. And they certainly do hold seats in Parliament now. And Hezbollah, whilst it has a form which appears political, and some states would just treat them as if they are a political identity, there is no doubt in most states' views that this is a malicious, vicious, terrorist-like group. So a bit like IRA Sinn Féin, that was. You've got a political wing and you've got a military wing, and it's the ones with the guns that really hold sway when it comes to Hezbollah. And they've had control of leading features of the economy in Lebanon. So for the international airport, for instance, and the docks, when you think of that bomb that went up on August the 4th, Hezbollah really controlled all that dock area and what was going in and what was going out. And I almost don't have to say this, but Hezbollah hate Israel, and Hezbollah fired rockets into Israel, and they've been sponsored also by the likes of Iran, which is a Shiite country. And they have been supported not only by them, but they pulled strings within Lebanon and robbed the Lebanese, where they have had successful business. Hezbollah have made rich pickings out of it. So they have had a major influence in recent years. Now, I want to bring it up a little bit more to date. I hope you're still awake, and there were one or two of you still with me and you haven't all switched off. Some additional problems to those I've already outlined. Syrian refugees. The United Nations will say there's 1 million Syrian refugees there. The Lebanese government, at least last year, was saying there was 1.5. In truth, there's probably nearer 2 million. Remember, this is a country of 6.8 million. That's an incredible influx. Really hard to manage is that. You know, Britain's worried last week, and there's 400 coming on a day, boats over the channel. We're talking here not hundreds, we're talking 1.5, 2 million, and you've only got a population of 6.8. That is a tough call to try and look after then. This might seem almost irrelevant, but it isn't. In Lebanon, they've got a terrible problem. For a long while, from the days of the Civil War, were dealing with their rubbish and their waste, terrible pollution problems. And it's sad that they decided in February to put 20 million to actually doing something with these horrible dumps they've got, which has led on to a lot of health problems. And of course, since February, there's been other issues. So I've got no idea where that 20 million is going now. Education. If I just say 300,000 Syrian children have come into their education system, you know, inverted commas, probably enough said to say that they're completely at a loss dealing with that one. And I take the opportunity of saying here that 40% of the population are fluent in French. Another 15% are pretty good at French, and the second language in their schools at secondary level is French. So the French influence in Lebanon has remained despite all this I've been saying about Hezbollah and so on. Legal system. Well, the French set up a good legal system, and in the 40s, 50s, 60s, as countries' legal systems go, seem reasonably equitable, something on a Western European style. But in recent years, the militiamen have got in there and all sorts of horrible things happen, mostly behind closed doors. And those that are judging have got no experience in judging. Torture, you can imagine, don't want to talk any more about that really, but the legal system's just gone. And on top of that, a desperate economy. The wheels, long time ago really, were loose. End of last year, basically they'd come off. And so, last October, and this passed me by, it probably passed a lot of us by, I guess the West, not interested, so it's not on the BBC, it's not on ITN. But there was a what's called a revolution last October, called the October Revolution, nicknamed the Tax Intifada. And the reason for that is, all, despite the fact there was over half the population unemployed, and they've got problems with electricity, water, sanitation, all those basic things failing, the real trigger that brought people out in the streets in a big way in all the major cities of Lebanon was the government wanted to put a tax on tobacco and petrol, okay, but also on things like WhatsApp. And that brought people out. And they weren't happy. That was the final straw. So this was last October. And the frustration that they have because of the government seems to be looking after itself, the ruling class, not really accountable to the average man. Eventually, the masses in Lebanon took to the streets in a big way. So let's get it up to date now. October the 4th, what happened? August the 4th, what happened? Ammonium nitrate, saltpeter, lots of it, blew up in that dock. Basically, it's not too dangerous a thing to handle overall, as things go in these areas. It's a very common substance used for mining and also in the world of agriculture. And it's usually quite stable, it's looked after. And there's been experience in the past of explosions, and I'll tell you in a moment, but really there's no excuse for what happened. In 2013, this ship came into Beirut dock with 2,750 tons, had a Russian crew, but the owners of the vessels were basically bankrupt. They couldn't pay the shipping fees, the port fees. The Lebanese authorities said, well, you're not taking your ship anywhere. You're not going to Mozambique. You're not going home. You're staying there. And the poor sailors, the Russian sailors, had to stay on that ship for a year. It was almost like a prison ship for them. And all the ammonium nitrate was taken off and just put it on dockside. And that's where it's been for the last 7 years. I'll just quickly run through here. Disasters with saltpeter. The first real big one, First World War in the UK. Even when we look it up, it's quite interesting to read. Won't bore with you now, but 115 died there. One intrigues me is the French one. Notice that in 2001, Toulouse, because my son doesn't live too far away from there. So that caught my eye. And then that happened 10 days after 9/11. You know, the terrible events in Manhattan. And so there was some concern at the time, you know, was this an accident or was this terrorist activity? Be that as it may, there's the list, and you've got the Lebanese there. Some say 200 died, I reckon 220 plus. But there's no excuse, really. It's not a difficult substance to look after, but if you are careless with it, then this sort of thing can happen. Terrorist activity, yes. The Oklahoma City bomb, that was saltpeter. So as I say, those in Toulouse and the French authorities in 2001 wondering, hang on, we're getting attacked like This happened with Timothy McVeigh and so on. You remember him? And the bomb that went off at the dockside, I think was significant. I was going to quote you a figure, but I won't, but significantly more tonnage involved than what that created, and 169 died in that. Okay. What's happened? Well, coronavirus, pandemic. Let's bring that to bear now. Lebanon's done reasonably well up to now. Only 200 deaths, which in comparative terms, given their population and so on, okay, they seem to have been spared. But their hospitals are working at capacity. Suddenly everything goes haywire on August the 4th. They actually had their main hospital hit badly in Beirut, and they're really, really stretched. They are finding it tough. And so what's happened now? Talk about social distancing, my brethren and sisters. There's the number of cases now in Lebanon, and it's going up sharp. And the deaths in Lebanon, from a small number admittedly, but it's gone on the increase. It's out of control, really. And as for coronavirus, you know, it's caused us economic problems. It certainly caused economic problems with them. I can't possibly go through this all this now. I'm looking at the clock. But banks have gone belly up, basically, in Lebanon. All their financial controls, just in a mess. They're already a terrible national debt, and they're just trying to pay the debt off and gone. Hezbollah, surprise, surprise, had their fingers in the financial world there, and they were doing quite well out of it. But someone just simply remarked that Lebanon produces little and imports about 80% of the goods it consumes. Now, that was before the disaster of the 4th of August. Before. So what's happening now, it's unimaginable. Now, 2 days after that blast, there's something remarkable happened. And I'll let you see this clip. I hope you've got the volume up. You might need the volume up on your laptop now so you can hear this. This is a clip from Sky News 2 days after that blast.
With a tidal wave of anger sweeping the country, President Macron stepped onto the shattered streets. All around him, desperate and furious voices shouted out for reform of a rotten political class, which they claim is responsible for the blast.
Look at our jobs! Look at our family! Look at our houses! And the
house. As he shook hands with victims of the disaster and listened to their stories, he also told me Lebanon needs much more than just supplies of aid.
I'm here to bring help, to help to coordinate. We will launch a European and international initiative to bring money and help directly to people. But at the other side, we have to launch a new political initiative to change in depth what is today at stake. Because all this nervosity that you see, all this fear, anger, this anxiety, real anger. This anger you have, is against politicians and against corruption in the country.
Everything is broken.
A lot of things. But you know, in this country, you have marvelous people. Lebanese people are so brave. So, this is our chance.
At times, his security detail lost their footing on the pavements of broken glass. But the French leader did something here that no Lebanese politician would dare to even think. He came and showed his face.
What's happening here is quite spectacular. President Macron's come onto the streets He's meeting people and hearing their concerns. And for many, they are seeing something that they've perhaps never seen before, and that's his real leadership. And that's why they're coming to him to demand for change.
But whilst his walkabout was well received, this gesture will amount to nothing if there is no concrete change. Serena Etoufi told him not to trust Lebanon's government, who he'd meet later.
He says he's going to meet with all the political leaders. They're the ones that have been, like, taking the country hostage since 1975.
So what is your message to the French president?
I told him, give the money to NGOs, give the money to the people in need, do not give it to the president.
The crowds here hope France, Lebanon's one-time colonial ruler and most supportive Western ally, will soon be able to come up with a lifeline along with the rest of the international community. It is, of course, no easy task. The country is dealing with a major disaster whilst already buckling under the weight of economic and political crises.
We need external help and support on all different aspects and levels.
To kick them out.
All my business is damaged. I don't mind, look. All my body is damaged. We don't care. We want them to leave Lebanon.
It will take billions to rebuild this city. But the irony for many Lebanese is that the destruction of the port is not even the real tragedy. The ruins here are just another terrible symbol of a corrupt ruling elite who've stolen all the people's wealth and now their hope too. Alex Rossi, Sky News, Beirut.
Macron is not necessarily the most popular man in France. In fact, I've seen a fair bit of evidence to know he's been pretty much disliked in France. I don't know about his politics, but what I do know, my dear brothers and sisters, that he was very, very brave that particular day amongst that crowd. He gave up on social distancing, and in the end, the people were hugging him and he was hugging them. He was reaching out, he was genuinely reaching out to them. But the thing that brought me to tears the first time I saw one of the other clips, which I won't share now because I fear we'll get emotional again, is that the people are so desperate. They're clinging to him because there's nobody else to turn to. There's just no one. And here's this man who's come on the scene who might just turn things around. Now, I want you to see this next clip, please.
With a tidal wave of anger sweeping the country, President Macron stepped onto the shattered streets.
No, this. Sorry about it, it's this one here. And what impressed me about this was, in that clip, is this idea that Lebanon should place itself under French control again. A mandate, a French mandate, resurrected as from the past. And it had been suggested that the French have ruled over Lebanon for 10 years. And almost straight away within Lebanon, this petition went round. 65,000 people signed it up. I haven't been able to find any more information, sadly, the last two or three weeks. I've searched the internet, can't find any more. So I don't know what's going on. But what I do understand and I want to share with you, brothers and sisters, is that the people in Lebanon are turning to France with this big hope that the French will help them. Mandate or no mandate, I mean, it's very unlikely the French want to have a mandate again. But I will tell you this, Macron's been back to Beirut, and he's also calling for a conference next month whereby people have got to sort out the Lebanon problem. He's taking charge of it. At a personal level, is Macron. So what I want us to take out from this is the French involvement of yesteryear is now being demanded of the people themselves for today and for tomorrow. They can't see anything other than having success, a rebuilding with French help and the French involvement. And Macron, you've seen his reaction, what he's doing. So now, take you to Ezekiel 38. Time's pressing. You can glance those words. Most of you will know those words virtually off by heart. I've had no problem in my many years in the truth with Gog and Magog and Meshach and Tubal, all that, referencing Russia. I've had no problem with that. I've had no difficulty with Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. I've had no difficulty with the House of Togarmah, commonly held view in Christadelphian circles from the days of Brother Thomas to refer to Turkey. I've had no difficulty with that. All the decades I've been in the truth, that's been fine. But I've had one big problem, brothers and sisters, one big problem all the way through, and that's been Gomer. Who is Gomer? Well, Brother John Alfrey's book on Ezekiel, that I know some of you will have on your shelf in your very own homes. If you look what he has to say about Gomer, he suggests that it's France. And there's this passage here from a historian from 1708, which talks of the peoples moving, spreading forth from, yes, the area of Turkey, but going into Europe and going north and then going west. And these end up being commonly called the Gauls, France. So in 1708, you've got this historian saying that there's a background to the French where there's this link of Gomer. If you also look in that book, he's got a map and he shows how these people of Gomer, as I say, were in Turkey. We've got the idea that the Scythians or the Cimmerians, that they're all these same peoples. And as they move north, they eventually go west. And we have the Gauls. Some of them even came into the British Isles, it seems. We have the Celts. But I want to get in the argument with Sam here this evening or David when I get back home. But it's interesting that it seems to be a commonly held view in Christadelphia that Gomer points to the French. And I've known that since the 1970s myself. And I've questioned that. I couldn't see it. Couldn't see it. Through the 1980s, couldn't see it. Through the 1990s, couldn't see it. The last 20 years, brothers and sisters, really struggled this idea of Gomer being the French. If you go on the internet and you look at other people explaining Ezekiel 38, other Christian groups, Pentecostals, evangelicals, and so on, I guess the most common thing they would say is it's Turkey, it's the Turkish people. But even amongst them, there are one or two that suggest it could do with France and Germany. But it's, you know, so this is not easy. And I'm not saying I'm totally convinced even now. It's not easy, it's difficult. But I see what's happening in the world today. And I share with you what's happening today in the Lebanon. And I just raise it with you, brothers and sisters. If you've had a problem with Gomer being France like I have, then think again, consider it again. There's just another map there, you know, Western Europe. You know, some make it more wider than just France. There you go. Then you can find other maps on the internet and you'll see something like this with someone I'm sorry it's not the clearest of the maps, but you can see there Goma being France. And then this fascinated me. Steamship. Yeah, that's interesting, steamship, Jeff. You can see why that might fascinate you. Yeah, but this steamship took Napoleon III to Britain. Napoleon III was the nephew of the Grand Napoleon that we all are familiar with. Napoleon and Wellington, 1815, Battle of Waterloo. Well, his nephew came to be the leader of France, and he's known as Louis Napoleon, or Napoleon III. And he made a state visit to Britain. And I've got a picture here of Queen Victoria meeting him in Portsmouth. And the name of his boat, the name of the ship, can you believe this? If you don't know this, you're going to be shocked. I was so surprised when I found this out a few weeks ago. The name of the ship that Napoleon III travelled and Queen Victoria saw him on was called the Goma. If you don't believe me, look it up. You'll find that easy. It was called the Goma. So even he was happy to be associated with the name Goma. It's just these little incidentals that somehow to me are worth a lot. And then there were problems with France, or potential problems with France, with this new Napoleon. He was quite ambitious. And as a result, there were some fortifications in Portsmouth. So I'm now showing you a map of Portsmouth. Now, why am I doing that? Well, I'm doing that because, I don't know if you can read that, but that's called Goma Lane. And there's an area in Portsmouth called Goma. There's actually a primary school called Goma Primary School. Goma. And this is because of this situation with Napoleon III. There were actually battlements built out in the sea. They won't bore you with all that. But there's an area of Portsmouth called Goma because of the fear of the French. Now, look at this picture. Lockdown. No one's going anywhere. You know, I think this was in May. Macron's speaking to our friend Putin. Macron is confident that we can make progress with Russia. This is the report on it. The French think they can deal with Putin. Macron thinks he's got a working relationship. They're talking to each other. And there's the proof of it. Even when they can't see each other face to face, just as I'm doing with you, my dear brothers and sisters, tonight, just as I'm doing with you, Macron finds the necessity and Putin has the interest to have a Zoom link and they have a conversation. As I say, Macron thinks that he can sort Putin out, even though I have problems with the Ukraine and so on, maybe with Crimea. So I'll come back to Ezekiel 38, verses 1 to 6. We know that's to do with Russia and so on. I don't think we're worried about that in terms of interpretation. Most brethren would accept that. Russia is now in Syria. Interesting, that, isn't it? Syria was part of that original French mandate of old. Russia are in Syria. They're building a port in Syria for their ships. And now we're getting France, just in these last few weeks, getting involved. In the last few weeks, my dear brothers and sisters, France getting involved with Lebanon. Russia and France will have to cooperate. You know, Lebanon's got 1.5 million Syrian refugees to deal with. Do you not think that when they're sorting out peace in Lebanon, Putin's going to have a word to say about it? Do you not think Macron's going to have a little word with Putin about it? Of course they're going to have to talk about it. They're going to have to cooperate. and they both wanted to talk to each other before. That blast on August the 4th has made things in the political heavens move, my dear brothers and sisters. I feel so much for the people. I really do. I just really feel for them. And as I say, I wonder about that friend of mine of all those years ago, whatever happened to him and his family. I feel Lebanon's been torn apart for so many times, desperate people. And when you see them basically imploring Macron to help, to help, to help, and they start arranging to try and get a mandate, a French mandate, you see their desperation. I feel for the people, brothers and sisters. And that's why I would like Brother Tim and our president tonight to read Psalm 72, not just it's got Lebanon in it, but because it speaks of the Lord Jesus. We know the only answer to Lebanon's problems, to Israel's problems, and to all the problems of the Middle East, to the whole problems of the whole earth, brothers and sisters, it's not Macron or any of the others, it's the Lord Jesus. And so let's lift our spirits and be cheered with that great hope that soon Psalm 72 is going to be fulfilled. May it come quickly.
So, reading Psalm chapter 72. Give the king thy judgment, O God, and thy righteousness unto the king's son. He shall judge thy people with righteousness, and thy poor with judgment. The mountains shall bring peace to the people, and the little hills by righteousness. He shall judge the poor of the people, he shall save the children of the needy, and shall break in pieces the oppressor. They shall fear thee as long as the sun and moon endureth throughout all generations. He shall come down like rain upon mown grass, as showers that water the earth. In his days the righteous flourish, and abundance of peace so long as the moon endureth. He shall have dominion also from sea to sea and from river, and from the rivers to the ends of the earth. They that dwell in the wilderness shall bow before him, and his enemies shall lick the dust. The kings of Tarshish and of the isle shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him, all nations shall serve him. For he shall deliver the needy when he crieth, the poor also, and him that hath no helper. He shall spare the poor and needy, and shall save the souls of the needy. He shall redeem their souls from deceit and violence, and precious shall be their blood in his sight. He shall live, and to him shall be given the gold of Sheba. Prayer also shall be made for him continually, and daily shall he be praised. There shall be a handful of corn upon the earth, upon the top of the mountains, and the fruit thereof shall shake like Lebanon, and they of the city shall flourish like grass of the earth. His name shall endure for ever, his name shall continue as long as the sun, and men shall be blessed in him, all nations shall call him blessed. Blessed be the Lord God, the Lord, the God of Israel, who only does wondrous things. And blessed be his glorious name for ever, and let the whole earth be filled with his glory. Amen and amen. The prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended.